Thanks, everyone, for joining the webinar this morning. And as Casey said, my name is Ann Yocum, and I work right now as the program manager at the Tulane Institute on Water Resources Law and Policy. And we focus largely on dealing with water law and policy issues in Louisiana, but in the larger Southeast and on national level issues as well. And I was speaking to Tony and Casey earlier, and the one common theme that sort of runs throughout all my jobs has been water. That's the only thing that all of them have in common. So I hope if you have any questions, please feel free to write them down or chat them to us, and we'll answer them throughout. And like I said, most of my work has been in Louisiana, so hopefully the sort of case studies that we present here today will have relevance across the board in the Southeast. So we're going to take a look first. I'm not sure where everyone's from, of course, and Google Map doesn't pop up with everyone's location, but in general, we know in the Southeast that the population has grown exponentially, really, since 1970. Across the Southeast, if you take the ebbs and flows in different states, we're looking at population growth rates upwards 30 to 40%. Now, a lot of that is inward migration, not just birth, you know, population births, but mostly inward migration, and a lot of that growth has been on the coast. And so we've got now major cities and major centers on the coast that didn't exist before 1970, particularly Florida and North Carolina, South Carolina. And then the Southeast as a whole, and most of you probably know this, but about a quarter of the nation's agricultural crops come from the Southeast, and that's, you know, everything from cotton to tobacco to citrus. And then I actually didn't know this until I was doing research for this presentation, that 50% of the nation's timber supplies come from the Southeast, and a lot of that is soft pine. And then most of us know probably as well that 50% of the wetlands in the lower 48 states are located here in the Southeast. A lot of those, of course, are in Florida and then here in the Gulf South in Louisiana. Though we have 50% of the wetlands in the lower 48, then this region loses about 3/4 of the national wetland lost every year. I'm just going to flip to the next. And we know a lot of the causes, human causes, that we have for global warming, and some of the human causes of global warming, what we're seeing as a result of our actions. And a lot of them have to do with water, and I find that to be the most fascinating thing. I don't feel like you can get water from climate change, because all the issues when we're dealing with climate change adaptation, and as we figure out what kind of policies we need, whether it to deal with agriculture, whether it be to deal with housing, et cetera, everything is related in some way to water. And number one, for all of us living on the coast, it's sea level rise. So that's one of the major things we're going to see, of course. And then we're also going to see rising temperatures, increasing carbon dioxide concentrations, and then, of course, changes in precipitation patterns. And we're going to go into these all a little bit more in depth. And I know maybe some of this was covered in the science of global warming, so hopefully it won't be too much of a review. So sea level rise, depending on what IPCC report you read, we're talking between 23 inches by the year 2100, and the estimates continue to rise. I mean, the new reports that I've been seeing is saying that 2 to 3 feet may not be unheard of. So, and a lot of this, of course, is based on the estimates that we see in the thermal expansion and the glacial melting, and also how fast the Greenland ice sheet is melting. And we're definitely concerned because it looks like that might be accelerating. And the picture on the right is from NASA, and you can see that the melt happening. So we often here in Louisiana are put on the front lines when it comes to thinking about, okay, coastal cities are at risk, but Miami actually has about almost 400,000 people in it, and because it is the gateway to America and known it for international air travel, with little over three feet of sea level rise, a lot of the downtown would be underwater. And so though New Orleans, here in New Orleans, we're always concerned about that, there are cities across the Southeast and in the Gulf Coast, Miami, and then cities on the coast in North Carolina and South Carolina that will also be underwater with 3 feet of sea level. And Dr. Bruin's Eastern Shoreline Loss Formula states that with each centimeter of sea level rise, we're losing a meter of beach. And so that in turn, of course, means that if a storm comes, either it be whether it be a hurricane up the North Carolina, South Carolina coast, that water and the waves from that water, the storm surge, is just going to hit the shoreline faster with greater energy. And so we know that the shorelines are continuing to erode. That's a natural processes, but with the sea level rise, it's going to happen at a faster rate. Coastal modeling suggests that possibly by 2080, we'll have a 33% loss of wetlands globally. And you can see this map in the corner on the left-hand side shows what, even at 1 meter, what the coastal wetlands that'll be lost in Louisiana. And it's 640,000 acres. And with that loss and with the impact on the wetlands here in the Gulf Coast, we're going to lose 25% of the nation's commercial fishing. And in the Southeast as a whole, we're talking about, I think it's about 35 to 40%. And when I was looking at the numbers yesterday, because again, I work mostly in Louisiana, so I was trying to get a better understanding. But so the impact on the nation's commercial fishing industry is going to be enormous. There are a number of reasons that are coming into play. So with coastal land loss, we know that there's going to be saltwater intrusion, and many of our freshwater and brackish marshes will become more saline. So we're going to lose some of those freshwater and brackish marshes. At the same time, we're going to be facing with climate change, we're going to be facing probably decreased flows in our freshwater streams, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that. And so you've got less freshwater coming into the marshes on the edges, and so that in turn just really creates almost like a perfect storm. So we were losing, number one, losing, we have saltwater intrusion, and then at the same time, we're reducing our upwards flows. So that's going to make those marshes even higher salinity content. So here we again say that saltwater contamination, it's a real concern here in Louisiana, and we're going to talk about it in other places in the Southeast as well. But there's going to be the higher the sea level rise, we're going to have salinity and saltwater intrusion into our groundwater. And then again, with being so close to the coast, a number of our agricultural industries, whether it be citrus or for us here in Louisiana, rice, are close enough that as the groundwater becomes more saline, that it can no longer be used for agriculture. And so these freshwater shortages that we're going to see an impact through the residential, agricultural, and industrial users. And we're going to look at some case studies where that's happening. So we know that global temperatures are increasing. And along with, of course, the temperatures increasing on land, we're also seeing our oceans, rivers, and lakes warming. And then the sea surface actually has increased about 1 degree Fahrenheit over the past 3 decades. So the things we're facing here in the Southeast, number one, with invasive species, as the temperatures increase, it allows invasive species to spread. A perfect example is the Chinese tallow, that in areas where it doesn't freeze, it's difficult to kill it, and it spreads very quickly. So Chinese tallow is a perfect example of an invasive species that is here in the lower Gulf South and is just going to spread farther and farther north and southeast in the Southeast, so hitting Tennessee over time. And, of course, we're going to see changes in water chemistry, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that. Increased hurricane intensity, which we've seen in the past, certainly in the past couple of years. It's more and more likely that we're seeing Category 5 storms, and if we see Category 2 or Category 1 storms, they actually often are larger and have increased intensity as well. So even though they're a Category 2, they're often larger in size or have increased strength. As I said, with invasive species, what you can expect to really see is that as the climate warms, we're going to have all these species being able to shift their ranges northward. And, of course, they can outcompete native inhabitants. And wetlands, particularly, are already highly susceptible because all the development that has occurred along our coast, all through the Southeast, has disrupted natural habitats. And so now it's more likely that an invasive species comes and can take root, they're going to be less likely, they're going to be more likely to be able to displace the natural ecosystem. And what we can see in water chemistry is with the higher temperatures, of course, we're going to have increased salinity. And because what's going to happen is it's going to leave behind concentrated salt water, of course. And again, when we're talking about increased salinity in the Gulf particularly, or even in our coastal marshes, you know, our coastal marshes are set up so that we often have that, so the saline marsh, the brackish marsh, and the freshwater marsh as you work your way in. And what's going to happen, like I said, is there's just going to be a continued loss of ecosystem. Some of the studies I've seen have actually shown that that brackish marsh area is just going to get smaller and smaller and smaller, and then slowly it's just going to be a saline marsh pushing up into the freshwater marsh. And so the length and the size of brackish marshes will probably shrink, and there'll be less. One of the major threats to the Gulf oysters industry here in Louisiana and also in the Gulf Coast of Florida is a pathogen that we know actually the infection rates go way up when the temperature and the salinity rise. So when we have to shut down our oyster industry, of course, it has a dramatic impact on the livelihood of the fishermen, but also it's a huge health risk for us as we're trying to ship our oysters out of state. And what we're going to do is, what also happens is that as water evaporates from the ground surface, you're going to lose that in two ways. We're losing it faster because the temperatures are hotter, so the water is going to evaporate faster from the ground itself and from surfaces, and then also water from plants is going to evaporate faster because of the heat as well. And so, as I mentioned earlier, as the temperatures rise, more water will be lost, and so that's going to indicate we're going to have lower river flows and lake levels and reductions in the water table, the water for wetlands, and in groundwater supplies. And droughts will become more common even if the rainfall levels remain the same, and that's really important to think about because we're going to talk about sort of some of the models that the some of the models and what they show for precipitation averages. But even if our precipitation goes up, if the temperatures are still hotter, that evapotranspiration rates are going to go up, and so it doesn't mean in the end that we're going to have more rain over a long period of time. We might have more extreme precipitation events, but in the end, we still may face longer droughts. And in the end, what we're really going to be facing, no matter what, is increased competition for all the decreasing freshwater resources that we're going to face. One of the things that happens with that decrease in with increased temperatures is that algae really like warm water, and so here in the Gulf Coast, we always have, during the summer, we often have what we call red tide, and it's a toxin that kills off fish, birds, and marine mammals, other organisms, and when they die off, that's when we have the dead zone, and so really there are these massive, large fish kills that happen because of the lack of oxygen. And as I mentioned, here's a picture of that all of us, I think, who've been through anything related with Katrina or any hurricane of the many that have hit Florida, Alabama, or North Carolina and South Carolina can look at and just see the size of Katrina. Again, it was a Cat 5, but it was this size across the Gulf that made it so devastating. And at least some of the models indicate, and there are certainly scientists that suggest that we can expect to see stronger, more intense storms as climate change continues, global warming continues. So as I mentioned, there are a number of models that are talking about what precipitation will look like here in the Southeast. And climate modeling in general has a difficult time, you know, getting it down to those what I call micro regions or microclimates. But at that regional level. But at the same time, when I was looking at all the different models, they predict largely that we're going to have a 15 to 20% increase in precipitation across the southeast. But that might mean, particularly for the Gulf Coast, they expect us actually, or for sort of Louisiana, Mississippi, and they expect in lower Alabama and Florida, they expect us to have actually less rain in specifically during our growing seasons, but other areas, but more rain during the, you know, during our summer raining seasons, et cetera. So, and the same thing could be said, I think they expect more rain in Tennessee and also in northern, in North Carolina and South Carolina. So that's a general, again, an average across the southeast. And again, as I said, the models, they have a hard time predicting where that's going to remain the same or decrease. But the bottom line is extreme precipitation events are going to be going to. So what does it mean? If we have the wetter scenario, it could mean that we'll have an increase in the number and size of dead zones in our Gulf. And that's largely because with every extreme precipitation event, going to push more more nutrients down, and so we're going to have more flooding. Our wastewater treatment plants, there's going to be more nutrients headed in our freshwater flows, so they're going to head into the Gulf of Mexico. Of course, an increase in destructive floods, and as I said, the sewage systems and surface and coastal waters with runoff. The drier scenario, of course, means that we'll have more and longer droughts. Probably an increased loss of wetlands because areas won't be continually, they won't have the natural flooding cycles. And then, of course, a drop in available freshwater resources. And my statement, though, about all of this is really is, does it matter? It doesn't, from the standpoint of whether we have more precipitation or less precipitation, we're still going to have to handle all these issues. And one is going to be shifts in agricultural production. We're going to probably see areas of the Mississippi Delta and northern Louisiana that are growing crops now that they won't be able to grow in 20 to 30 to 40 years. There are going to be rice crops. There are going to be citrus crops impacted. So there's going to be dramatic shifts in what can be grown in specific places or specific areas in the Southeast. And it's one of the things that I think we all have to get ready to respond to. And then again, there are going to be fisheries and forestry impacts. Again, we're going to see shifts in where pine can be harvested and shifts of where freshwater, the impact on our freshwater species and also our more marine species of fish are going to be great, whether we have more precipitation or less precipitation. All the fisheries are going to be impacted. And we're going to have a decrease in biodiversity. We're going to, if there's decreased freshwater flows, that means the fish that are living in the fish and mammals and or the fish and the species that are living in our freshwater rivers are going to struggle. And if we have more precipitation and for some reason that there's an increased nutrient flow, those our marine species are going to struggle as well. So there's going to be a loss of biodiversity. And the bottom line is there's going to be increased competition for freshwater resources. Either if it gets wetter and it's only extreme precipitation events, we're still going to have the same challenges not having enough water. So extreme precipitation events, we know they've increased in the past 60 years. Of course, with evaporation increasing, the warmer air can't store the water, store more of the water vapor. And so, of course, we have dramatic flooding. And the estimates of where that, and this was just the 1990s before we have the information on Katrina and Gustav and Ike. And so $50 billion worth of damage were caused just by recent floods in the 1990s. And so to understand, I thought it was important to give sort of a background of all the issues that we're going to be facing that are related to water and climate change. But then I wanted to give sort of the basics, what I call the basics of freshwater law. And the most important thing to remember through it all, really, is that for the most part, state laws determine property rights to use water. So there's no national law that trumps everyone, and so it's a state-by-state-by-state decision on how they how they enforce their laws and also how they define ownership and property ownership of fresh water. And so it's a little bit easier with fresh water and running fresh water than it is with groundwater. So we're going to start with fresh water because there are only two doctrines, really, to make it simple. The eastern part of the state, eastern part of the United States, including the southeast, which we've always thought to be sort of water abundance, that before, you know, the last 20 years, it was always seen as water was an abundant natural resource. And they abide by the riparian doctrine, where if you own the land adjacent to a body of water, then you have the right to use that water in a reasonable, quote-unquote, reasonable way, and you can make natural use of that water to meet your residential needs. Now, reasonable is defined differently state by state, and that's when it becomes a question that's often brought into the court. So when it is the riparian doctrine with eastern states, if there's a specific issue, you know, Joe and Paul both want water, or Joe and Susan both want water, they live next to each other, one of them is upstream, has been drawing water for a long time to water their garden and also their pool, and now they've put in a larger pool. This is a simple example, but they've put in a larger pool, they need more water, and if that impacts the person below, the downstream user, Susan, she has the right under the riparian doctrine to make a case that now that she's been impacted, and then the case will go to court, and then she may or may not get right to that downstream flow again. And in the reality with Eastern, because over time, it's, you know, the layers of freshwater law has gotten more, and freshwater policy has gotten more and more complex with the fact that we know we need to worry about pollutants, et cetera, and the water quality issues, not just water quantity issues. In Eastern states now, often there are multiple layers to permit to either withdraw.
Hi, welcome to the webinar. Sorry, if you could just please mute your phone.
Okay, sorry, I'm late.
So if you need to, so for example, with whether if you need a permit, whether it be for an industry or whether it be, there's a permitting process in place now that didn't exist when this doctrine was initially, was initially drawn up. And riparian doctrine is actually, this is where history comes into play, because when we look at the Western states, their doctrine, prior appropriation, is largely based on Spanish law, where the riparian doctrine has sort of found its roots in British common law, which I think is fascinating. We're going to go to the prior appropriation doctrine that most Western states use. California is a mix, and so we're not going to really focus on California because it would take us a long time, and there are multiple layers. But with the prior appropriation doctrine, the difference is that the water right belongs to anyone who first diverts water from its natural setting and puts it to a beneficial use anywhere. And that right to ownership remains valid as long as the water is used for the initial purpose. So if someone, we have in the West, you have a senior appropriator and a junior appropriator. So if a senior appropriator decides that when they took ownership of the water, they used it for irrigation. If they were so inclined to use it for something other than irrigation, whether to to sell it to a city, et cetera, to a municipality, they would lose their rights as a senior appropriator. So you can't shift the use. It's tied together. So the time and the use are tied together for ownership. Whereas in the East, you know, it's location. But for the West, it's if you divert the water, you come up with a use for it, you then own it. And one of the things that's been challenging, of course, the West developed the system because there was a limited amount of water even when the West was beginning to be developed. And so you got ownership of the water if you took control of the water. And so there's a picture of that's Lake Powell in the corner, which I think is fitting to sort of the idea of controlling the water and the flows. So there are some options if there are conflicts over managing fresh water. There freshwater resources. There are three options, really, and to deal with conflict. And one is legislative or congressional apportionment. That doesn't happen very often. And then there's litigation, which happens more often than not. And then between states, there's interstate compacts. And what we're going to see more and more, and what we're already seeing, is that interstate compacts become more and more difficult, because one of the things that interstate compacts require is that states need to be able to define what their water needs are and what their water needs will be, and also what upstream and downstream flows are going to be. And so with climate change, I think one of the things we're really looking at is, as these interstate compacts, and we're going to, I mean, for those of you in Alabama, Florida, and Georgia, you're well versed in all of this. So, but one of the things we're going to see is that more and more, even the compacts that have already been signed, it's going to be more and more difficult to find common ground, because those we can no longer say we're going to have this much water in 50 years, or this is what we can estimate, even with the models, because the models are still trying to figure that out. So the water wars, and I'm sure there are people on the phone who know much more about this conflict than I do, so feel free to ask questions or add at the end, because I just wanted to raise the conflict, really, between the Apalachicola, the Chattahoochee Flint, and then the Alabama Coosa Tallapoosa. I call it the ACF and ACT because I can't spit that out fast enough. But I think the situation between Alabama, Florida, and Georgia is really just telling of what's to come for many interstate sort of water in-stream flows, rivers that we have throughout the United States. And so, you know, in Alabama, Florida, and Georgia, we have these competing interests. We've got the drinking water, particularly for Atlanta and growing cities. We've got industry needs. We've got the needs of the fisheries and agriculture, particularly in Alabama and then in Florida, and then the endangered species habitat, which is there since the 1970s. In the 1970s, for what we need and what we're requiring our water to serve. And before 1970, really, the ending, really 1975, 1980 is when some of the first litigation happened, where the Endangered Species Act and the requirement for habitat was now added into the equation of how much water needed to go between upstream and downstream. And that's one of the key factors in the conflict between Alabama, Florida, and also, of course, the upstream-downstream debate about how much water is being used by Atlanta and Georgia, and then how much water, how much of the impact on the fisheries that we're seeing in Florida is because of the reduced downstream flow, or is it because of other environmental factors? So those are some of the environmental factors, or whether it be the pathogen that we were speaking of earlier. So those are some of the debates that are happening, and I think it's just really a sign of what's to come. Now, with groundwater, it's a little bit more difficult to determine. So because there are five doctrines, and it's a state-by-state decision, and unlike with freshwater resources, where we have a riparian sort of mostly in the eastern half of the country, and then the prior appropriation in the western half of the country, with groundwater, it's very hit or miss across the country, and we have everything from riparian to prior appropriation to what Texas has, which is absolute capture, where if you own a piece of property and you can draw water from an aquifer, whether it be under your property or not, you own that water as much as you can gather from an aquifer. So that's the absolute capture. So if you can grab the water, then it's yours. And the challenges with groundwater, of course, are also at this point, every state has developed all these different levels for permitting, also for management. So there are commissions, for example, in Louisiana, you know, some of specific groundwater aquifers have a a specific commission or that manage them. And so there are these multiple layers of management, which makes it very difficult to figure out who owns what. And therefore, they're often also very rarely litigated. So you don't have as many, sort of the common law, or you don't have the jurisprudence to figure out what the legal tradition to figure out who owns what and to be able to fall back on, the case law to fall back on. So for Louisiana, here's a what I think is a beautiful map from the USGS, and it shows the aquifers in Louisiana. And we've always, of course, consider ourselves a water-rich state. And because of that, we've done very little to manage our freshwater resources from the standpoint of having strong laws on the book about who owns them or who has the right to use them or how they need to be used. Besides, we don't go much above and beyond what's required by the federal government when it comes to permitting, et cetera. And when it comes to groundwater, most of our we have a few acts, and some of them suggest that we are an absolute capture state. Some of them suggest that we follow more riparian tradition. And one of the most recent law, which was a groundwater, or most recent case that was a groundwater case, was actually from, I think it was the 1920s, 1930s, which obviously shows you that we're not really responding to a lot of these challenges. And in that case, they suggested that we needed stronger policy, and that these questions need to be answered through the policy route, which we just haven't done. We have a groundwater commission that got off the ground in the late 90s, early 2000, but it really hasn't gone very far. And so when you look at our aquifers, there are four major ones, but there are two I want to focus on. The Sparta aquifer is the pink, so it's the pink aquifer in northern Louisiana, and then there's the Chico aquifer, which is the green aquifer in the left-hand corner of the state. And in all of our other four major aquifers, though, we're facing saltwater encroachment and water level declines and decreased water quality. And in the Chico aquifer, that's actually where a lot of our rice is grown. And so the increasing salinity there is impacting, is beginning to impact our agricultural industry. And also you can see that's the area as well, since it's close to the coast, that's where there's going to be continued saltwater intrusion just because of sea level rise. There's going to be a great impact there. And then now the Sparta aquifer in northern Louisiana is fascinating because the drawdown there is a combination of industry and public use, where the Chico aquifer, almost, I think it's 60% of the water is used for, is actually used for agriculture. But in the Sparta, it's a combination of industrial and public use. And what we're finding is that that's also the region where there's the potential for oil shale development. So one of the things that we're seeing is that Sparta area has been, that aquifer has been designated area of groundwater concern. All that has meant in Louisiana is that there's been increased education and that the wells have to be registered, and now they have to report in a more succinct way about how much they're withdrawing. But it hasn't really created any large-scale change, whereas in Georgia, when there was a drought in Atlanta, there was a dramatic push and requirement to recycle water, and same with Florida. And so none of that has really happened yet in southern Louisiana. So connecting energy and water, and I think this is a really important topic that often gets left out. One of the things with oil shale is that I was reading recently, and we're seeing this in northern Louisiana as well, it's come down a little bit with the economic recession, but a huge oil shale field was found in northern Louisiana, and it takes a lot, there are major concerns about the impact on drawing down water, the drawing down of water that it takes to get the oil shale, and then the chemicals that are used to get the oil shale interfering and getting into groundwater. So I know in the Colorado River Basin, I was reading yesterday actually that the oil shale industry or the energy companies have gotten water rights to what is equivalent to the upper Colorado River Basin in specific areas throughout the Colorado River Basin so that they can use that for oil shale collection and drilling. So that, and when you think about that, they now have those rights, that means someone downstream doesn't have those rights. And if they have those they have the first right, then those with downstream rights in the West have they're out of luck for getting water. And then the other obviously thing we need to think about is hydroelectric and thermoelectric power. With hydroelectric, which isn't as big an issue here in the Southeast as it is in the Northwest, if you have decreased freshwater flows, then you're going to have decreased amounts of water running through hydroelectric systems. So that's going to also impact your ability to produce energy. And then for us, the oil and gas industry, with increasing saltwater intrusion, I mean, we've got corrosion. I mean, the relationship to wetland erosion is one thing, but we're going to have corrosion in all of our oil and gas pipelines as well. And so those are just some of the issues that we're looking at when it comes to energy and water. And I think one of the things that Louisiana has found, if I can just go back to the map, one of the things with the Mississippi River, right, we can see that alluvial floodplain is the Mississippi River for us. And one of the things that we're really working on here in Louisiana is that we need to start thinking about what is going to happen to the Mississippi River. There's always been an effort, not always, but definitely it hasn't been, it's not something new, but that there's been an effort to do interstate transfers of freshwater, so that here in Louisiana, where we feel like we're freshwater, you know, we've got so much water and we need to learn to live with it and get rid of it, one of the things that we have to have waters and policy in place to handle is to be able to, when people want to transfer the Mississippi River out of Louisiana or even upstream, which is the woman who's in charge of the Southern Nevada Water District brought up transferring from the Mississippi and the Missouri River Basin a few weeks ago at a conference. And, you know, obviously in Louisiana, we need that some of that downstream flow, because that's hopefully in the long run what's going to give us coastal wetland protection. So there is the states that feel like they have a lot of water are starting to have to think about seeing water as an asset and something they have to manage. So one thing I wanted to just speak about briefly, because I know I'm running up on my time, is that a project that we're working on here in Louisiana is this idea that we need to learn to live with water, and that's in relation to climate change, of course, and what that means to us. And so for us, that's going to mean three things. We need coastal restoration, storm protection, and then we need to build resilient communities. And so one of the projects we're working on is really fascinating. It's got three diverse communities. The United Homa Nation that live in the southern Lufush and Terrebonne parishes largely, so southeastern Louisiana on the bayou, and then two communities in New Orleans, the lower Ninth Ward, which of course took severe flooding after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, and then the Holly Grove Carrollton neighborhood, which is in within the flood wall system, but also flooded during Katrina, some of it flooded during Katrina. And the goal of this project, which I think has resonance for the rest of the Southeast, is that what we're doing is with the communities, academic institutions, and sort of local and national nonprofits and technical expertise, and then also bringing in philanthropy dollars to work with each of these communities to address issues of climate change and water. And a lot of that for us has to do with all these water-related climate change issues, sea level rise, increased hurricane storms, and then, of course, we have to handle infrastructure and just everyday flooding that we're going to handle because of these more extreme precipitation events. And what it's done is created a great space of collaboration. And so I threw up some photos, and some of the issues that we're dealing with are, of course, these, you know, emergency preparedness and response issues, knowing that in Louisiana and all across the Gulf South, and we're going to be facing hurricane systems that are more frequent. And so we need to be able to see that this is our daily existence. It's not something that's quote-unquote a disaster anymore. It's something that we have to be prepared to live with. And so having systems in place that can be able to respond to people's needs and helping people get back as soon as possible. And then dealing with issues of drainage that are going to be ongoing problems, whether it be through rain gardens and then access to food through markets and urban agriculture and local production. And then it's created a space for communities to collaborate, but I think absolutely perhaps the most important thing, and I'll stress this at the end, which we're almost to, is that it's also created this great space for communities to actually influence policy. We are not, certainly I'm not an advocate in its sort of today, I want to say, current use of the word, but what we've done is create a space where communities can advocate for what they need and through this project. So it's created a space for them to influence policy in a different way. And so in closing, I think in the Southeast, what we're going to see in our new water world and what we need are going to be water laws and policies that incorporate climate change. And that's I could go on and on about what that really means, but there are a number of things that we really need to look at. Number one is groundwater withdrawals. We know that there's going to be increased groundwater withdrawals, and we need to have systems in place to manage them. I know in Louisiana that's something that's missing right now. Discharge permits. Right now, discharge permits are based on the flows that we have for in stream, but with evapotranspiration and increased temperatures, what we're going to see is decreased flows. So we're going to have to change our discharge permitting process because it's based on past. It's going to be based on past data. And how can we create a discharge permit process that's actually forward thinking instead of basing on knowledge that we have today, which is going to be dramatic shift. I don't know how we go about doing that, but if anyone has ideas, that's great. We need statewide management plans that understand and at watershed levels and understand the interactions. Of course, building codes and hazard mitigation, we consider that as water law and policy as well. Of course, and then encouraging community adaptation efforts and figuring out how we can develop laws and policies that support those processes. And part of that for us is working, with the national floodplain managers and figuring out how we can influence them, and working with the Department of Homeland Security and figuring out how do we create infrastructure in these institutions that can respond to what we see as our new world. It's not going to be just one Katrina, one Rita, one Andrew. It's going to be a continually sort of onslaught of storms that we're going to have that we have to learn to live with and adapt. And same with sea level rise. And then continued funding of research and development and on a number of different areas, whether that be on salinization and what to do with salinization, when you desalinize water, what to do with the saline, the salt that's produced, whether it be on more research on water banking. And then, of course, there's the role of the federal government. And there is a space, and I think what we're going to see in the not too distant future is that the federal government's going to get more involved in regulating interstate water because they can do that under the Commerce Clause in the Constitution. So they could start looking at water in that regard. And I think that may have to happen in regards to climate change.